Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
That was the game of the year last night. And if that's not the best game that we see all year, I can't wait to see a game that's better than that, because that was amazing. I mean, that was incredible last night. And yes, I know there's this prisoner of the moment field of sports these days. You know, people talk about whatever happened last night as if it was the greatest thing ever. Well, probably knowing deep down that they'll forget about it maybe a few weeks later. Yeah, I don't think that's the case with last night. That really is a game that's going to be remembered for a long, long time, because that game had everything. Division rivals, prime time in December, multiple lead changes, an iconic return from the locker room, a game-winning field goal at distance in crazy wins. You know that old heavyweight fight cliche that has been absolutely beaten into the ground, buried, dug up, beaten into the ground, buried again. And it's too bad, because it really is the perfect description for what went down last night. A couple of teams just standing in the middle of the ring, standing flat-footed, trading haymakers like some Rocky and Apollo Creed bleep. I mean, no defense, no lateral movement, nobody looking to slip any punches, just a couple of heavyweights standing flat-footed in the center of the ring looking to land a kill shot. And you could tell it from the very jump, from the very first drive. The Browns went 81 yards in 11 plays. It was a Kevin Stefanski special. Mixing the run and the pass, throwing in a wide receiver pass, and then closing it out with Nick Chubb finishing it off with a TD run.
Handoff, Chubb breaks a tackle over the center of the five and into the end zone. Touchdown, Cleveland. Nick Chubb, a 7-yard touchdown run.
And leave it up to Nick Chubb to find a hole. Put your foot in the ground, puts his left foot in the ground, runs through a tackle, runs over another tackle on his way to the end zone.
Westwood won. That drive was a clinic. On why Stefanski is awesome. And the team is awesome. But Baltimore responded. And they did it in a way that they had to do it. With Lamar Jackson finally looking again like Lamar Jackson. The reigning MVP was in the building last night. That was the old Lamar Jackson. Spreading the ball around in the air. And absolutely carving the defense on the ground. You could tell in the very first plays that the MVP was in the house. Like, Baker Mayfield was not the only dude who woke up feeling dangerous. Watching Lamar, I thought, damn, dude looks spry. Then I thought, bleep, spry. My man is flat out explosive tonight. This dude is wrecking shop. He's playing with an unbelievable sense of urgency. Except those plays when he was on roller skates. But other than that, his quicks were back. I mean, like Mike Vick quick. And you knew when they got him another pair of cleats, the Browns defense was going to be in for a long night. Any defense would be in for a long night when Lamar Jackson is out there doing things like this.
Shotgun snap is belt high, fake handoff and a run by Jackson over the guard into the end zone, slicing his way for a Baltimore touchdown. Wow, he got skinny as he got to the three and worked right along the hash mark, right into the middle of the end zone in a 5-yard touchdown run.
Lamar Jackson's already skinny. I don't think he has to get skinny.
Like I said, the reigning MVP was in the house, and he was getting nice. He chased that with his second, or in the second quarter with this.
First and 10, got the shotgun snap, moves up in the pocket, looks left. No, now he runs from the 20. Inside the numbers, the 15, the 10, the 5. Touchdown! Jackson does it again. Sprinting this time. Flag is down. He just ran that baby in.
Huge, huge turn of events.
Huge turn of events, and then the Tecmo Bowl moves in the third quarter.
Shotgun snap, fakes the handoff, runs it himself over the tackle, the 40. On the numbers, the 45, to the near sideline, the 50, a foot race to the 40. They're chasing him on the numbers to the 30, breaks the tackle there. Stiff arms his way to the 25, runs to the middle of the field, the 20, and down to the Cleveland 19. He cannot be stopped. Electrifying Lamar Jackson, a burst of 44.
Electrifying is right. I mean, that's the Lamar Jackson that we know, we love, we fear. That's the guy who was the best player in the league last year. That's the guy who hasn't quite been around at times this year. Like, it doesn't matter who you were rooting for. It was good to have that guy back. Because, damn, he was electric. He was explosive. All right, so maybe explosive is not the right word. Or maybe it is the right word. Anyway, Because just like that, he was gone. Just like that, he was gone. He was dominating. And then he goes back to the locker room to deal with cramps. Allegedly. I mean, when they first dropped that report that he was dealing with cramps, my first thought was, cramps? In December? In that cold? What? Anyway, hold that thought. I'll get into all the conspiracy theories in a moment. But while he was dealing with whatever it was he was dealing with, the Browns went to work. They came back from a tough interception from Baker Mayfield, his first in what seemed like forever. It left them with their backs up against the wall, down 14 going into the fourth quarter. But they came out swinging and landing. Touchdown to Hollywood Higgins, a two-point conversion. You know, a lot of people were shaking their heads like, wait, what are they doing? Analytics, yo. Analytics. Then they followed this by Mayfield.
Shotgun snap, backpedaling three, cocks his arm, pump fakes, flush from the pocket, running to the far side, the 10, race to the 5, into the end zone! Touchdown, Mayfield! Touchdown, Cleveland Browns! They have come back to tie at 34 with the extra point coming up in 6.
And how about that? They come all the way back, they tie that game. The run was great. The slide was even better. A huge moment, not just in that game, but in the season, because it drove home the point. This Browns team is different. This Browns team is not going away. This Browns team is not going to melt down. They're not going to be happy with the good effort. They're not happy with the good job, good effort. Man, they're going to grind. They're going to battle. They've got heart. They've got grit. And it looked like they were going to rip this thing because they had all the mo at their back and they had Lamar Jackson in the locker room. Then, on the next series, the Cleveland defense had Baltimore in a 3rd and 10. But backup Trace McSorley hit Willie Snead for 13 yards to keep that drive alive. Man, that was clutch. Clutch as hell for McSorley to come off the bench, ice cold, late in the fourth, in a game with their season possibly hanging in the balance, and this guy converts. But then, on 3rd and 2, from the Cleveland 41, this happened.
Runs it himself, cuts right, slips on the grass, down he goes. Myles Garrett runs and puts his big body on McSorley, who is down. McSorley is injured, holding on to his left knee. So he is injured and holding on to his knee.
4th and 5, game on the line, season probably on the line. And here comes Lamar, and Lamar goes legend.
Shotgun snap, 4th and 5, runs out of the pocket, past the hash mark on the numbers, downfield throws, it's caught at the 20, wide open is Brown, he goes from the 10 to the 5, it's a touchdown! Baltimore comes right back, and they get the touchdown pass of 44 yards!
Wow!
Oh my goodness!
You're right, you can't make this stuff up.
This is just amazing!
I mean, are you kidding me? If that game ended right there, that would have been incredible. It would have been unbelievable, but it didn't, because the Browns did come flying right back. Baker to DPJ, Baker to Jarvis Landry, Baker to Kareem Hunt, Baker to Hunt one more time.
Clock is at 110, Mayfield 319 yards, shotgun snap, line drive throw, backpedaling catch, Hunt 15, breaks a tackle 10, to the 5, to the pylon, touchdown! Cleveland has scored! Cleveland has scored! Trailing by one with 104 to go on a 22-yard touchdown. Catch and run. Kareem Hunt scores.
Clutch as hell. Brass as hell. And for any of you dopes thinking that the Browns were not ready for prime time, that all they did was get fat on cupcakes, you could shut the hell up right about now, because that drive was brass as hell. In fact, the only thing bad about that drive, and you had to know it right when it happened, is that they actually scored too quickly. If you're a Browns fan, you had to be thinking, oh man, that was so awesome, but they scored too quickly. They left too much time on the clock for Lamar Jackson. There was no way Jackson was going to let Baltimore lose last night. Nobody and no one thing was going to keep Lamar down last night. Not explosive diarrhea. Devastating cramps or anything else. Man, this guy was possessed. This dude just was not going to be denied. This dude was not going to let his team lose or his season potentially end. 4 quick passes, a spike, and then this.
It'll be a 55-yard try for the lead. On the grass with wind, Ball put down, right-footed kick is up, arching up, end over end, and it is good! 2 seconds remain, 55-yard field goal by Justin Tucker.
Justin Tucker, man, this dude is unconscious. He is ice cold. So clutch, so impressive, especially when you consider the crazy wind that was whipping around. And the fact that Baltimore absolutely had to have that. They beat the Cowboys last week, right? I said I was not impressed because they only beat the Cowboys. Now they have beaten a good team on the road when their star quarterback was dealing with, hell, I don't know, whatever he was dealing with. I'm impressed. I'm hella impressed. I cannot say enough about Lamar Jackson. I mean, for three quarters, his offensive line was struggling. His receivers were struggling. So he put up a new Monday Night Football quarterback rushing record with 124 yards and two TDs. And he missed a big chunk of the game, and then he came back and he threw for more yards in the final 2 minutes than he did in the previous 58. Like I said, with their season on the line, the MVP was back in the house last night. However, if you're looking to come in here and bury the Browns, don't. Man, you can take that crap someplace else. Hell yes, this is a team that is way beyond moral victories, but that was still a strong night for the Browns. I mean, losing the game sucks, no doubt. It was the ultimate kick in the junk and blast in the package. It was brutal. But they underlined yet again, they're legit. They didn't play their best game. Not at all. They ate some serious punches. They kept fighting their asses off. They kept getting up off the mat. Just know, they're not about the moral victory. You know they're pissed, and they should be. They should be 10-3 this morning. They should be, they could be. If they make a play, they get the hell off the field defensively. They are 10-3 this morning. And how different would the world look at 10-3? They should be, but they're not because, well, Lamar Jackson.
Jackson?
Like, I'm not sure anyone or anything was beating Lamar Jackson last night. Not the Browns, not debilitating cramps, not explosive diarrhea, not anything, whatever it was. Speaking of the runs, like I've always said that explosive diarrhea is the great equalizer.
Diarrhea.
Even when I denied saying it because
equalizer.
I forgot that I said it.
Diarrhea.
All right,
is
so I said
great
it.
Great equalizer.
I said it and I believed it and I thought it was undefeated. Come to find out it's not, allegedly. Come to find out, you know what the great equalizer is? Freaking Lamar Jackson.
Jackson.
Because this dude was absolutely incredible last night. Playing like he did with whatever it was he was dealing with. Man, what a game. Hey, clones, are you craving some protein after a good workout? This time, don't make a shake or eat a bar. Instead, grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper. Why, you ask? Because Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty and tender and made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a wood fire. Old Trapper is a family-owned business. They take their smoked beef extremely seriously, and you can taste it in every single bite. I mean, who wants dried, tough beef in a bag? Nobody. It's like eating a shoe. Old Trapper, though, is the real deal, and it comes in four amazing flavors. Old Fashioned, Teriyaki, Peppered, and Hot and Spicy. So the next time you want a great protein and energy snack that you can have anytime, anywhere, grab some Old Trapper beef jerky. Make sure to look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. That way you can see the quality that you're getting. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, clones, ask for it by name because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? He is a good friend of the program. He is Michael Malone. Michael, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
Great, Jim. It's always great to be on with you, man, and hope you and your family are staying safe during these crazy times.
Yeah, we certainly are, Michael. I would say the same about you. Great to have you back, and I hope you and your family are well, too. And I can't believe I'm saying it, but is the season opener really in 8 days? I mean, it feels like last week you guys were coming back from down 3-1 in back-to-back series and making history. So how does it feel to be preparing for the season opener?
Yeah, I feel like you, Jim. It's kind of crazy when you think about that, and literally just over 2 months ago, we were playing the Lakers in the Western Conference Finals, and here we are back in training camp. And on the 23rd, the season opens for real. And, you know, I put myself in our players' shoes, guys like Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic, who were in the bubble for 83 days and shortest off season in professional sports history. All right, here we go, guys. 2 months later, we got to do it all over again and be better. So it's you feel rushed. I'll be honest, I felt overwhelmed at times because this season is coming at all of us. It seems like in warp speed, but everybody's in the same boat, and we'll have to find a way to, you know, implement our seven new players and rely on our returning players to get off to a great start.
We're talking to Michael Malone. You know, Michael, you mentioned about three or four things that I wanted to ask you about, that there's such a quick turnaround and you've got some new guys that you need to incorporate. And I can appreciate you saying that even you at times felt like you were overwhelmed. So how do you go about working in a number of these new faces? How do you go about trying to get everybody on the same page and up to speed? What is your process?
Yeah, it's, you know, for the last few years, and I think all the listeners realize this, Denver, the strength that we've had has been our continuity. You know, we've been a team that's brought back the same team largely every season, and that has played to our advantage. Well, this is the first time in my 5 years going on six where we have had quite a bit of turnover. Seven new players, six players did not return. And you can't rush it. It's not something I can wave a magic wand and say, hey, we've created this chemistry on the court and off the court and this, you know, getting to know you. But we have a great locker room. We have a great culture. All of our returning players have not only welcomed the new guys, but I gave them a challenge of making sure that you go out of your way to help them on and off the court, to feel a part of this, to help them on the court. They're not sure where to go because someone once did that for you many years ago. And our guys have taken that to heart. So we played one preseason game, Jim, at Golden State. And I love the fact that the bench was in it the whole night. The starters were up rooting for the guys in the game. And that to me shows that they care for each other and understand the importance of being a selfless team.
We are talking to Michael Malone. You know, to that point, Michael, I wonder, like, the culture has been established and there's been so much continuity and consistency. And as you point out, that's one of the reasons for your success there. So does the identity of the team change a little bit when you add new faces, or is the point to make sure that the new faces integrate with the existing identity and culture?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. I think, Jim, it's important for our seven new players to understand full well, hey, what is our culture about? Work, selfless, trust. Okay, what is our culture? Defend, rebound, run with discipline, value and share the ball. That is who we've been. That has allowed us to have great success in the last 5 years. We have improved every season, and the culture and the identity has been a big part of that. So it's up to the seven new players, a veteran like Jamichael Green, or two rookie draft picks like Zeke Nagy and R.J. Hampton, to understand that and to buy in and commit to that. And obviously, it's a learning curve. You know, I feel bad for all NBA rookies. All NBA rookies usually have a summer league, a month or two to get ready for the season, a ramp up. There's been no ramp up. These guys are being thrown to the wolves, and I give our guys credit because they've handled it extremely well so far.
We are talking to Michael Malone. All right, Michael, you mentioned Jamal Murray. Let me ask you about him because you and I have talked about him in the past and his growth as a player and a leader during his time with you. But it feels like to me and to the rest of the world, I think, we found out in the bubble exactly what he's all about. So what does the next step in his growth look like as a player?
Well, I would just echo your sentiments. I thought in the bubble, Jamal Murray was unbelievable. Our first playoff experience a year prior, Nikola Jokic showed the world what he's capable of. Hey, I'm the best center in the NBA. And Jamal was really good, but a little inconsistent. Well, year two in the playoffs for us, it was great to see Jamal kind of ascend to the same level as Nikola Jokic. So now we have two consistent superstars, and Jamal did it at a very high level in 19 playoff games. We don't get out of that Utah series without Jamal putting on a spectacular show. So now what are the challenges going into this year? Well, the first thing is, can you do the same thing over 72 games? You know, Jamal has yet to be named an All-Star, an All-NBA player. So if he wants to achieve those things, he needs to bring it from game one all the way through game 72. And that's his biggest challenge. And secondly, I think for him and Nikola to continue to find their voice, be leaders, and it shouldn't always be coming from me as a head coach. Great teams hold each other accountable, player to player. And that's what I need more from Jamal and Nikola in that regard. So Jamal understands that. And for a young player, I think he's really looking forward to that challenge of proving himself. What I did in the bubble was unbelievable, but I still have more room to grow. And I can bring this every single night with this Denver Nuggets team.
Denver Nuggets head coach Michael Malone joining us once again, having another great conversation. All right, so if you've got, Michael, the two established superstars, then that brings me to Michael Porter Jr., another player who people started to take notice of in the bubble. What did he show you in the way he handled those moments, and does it feel like that he might be a third member of a big three?
Yeah, you know, you have to give Michael a lot of credit. So we went down to the bubble having already clinched a playoff spot. But in the eight seeding games that we played, you know, Michael was phenomenal. You know, he was named all bubble, for whatever that's worth, right? But more importantly, as a true rookie, Michael goes into the playoffs, and again, 19 playoff games, three different series on our way to the Western Conference Finals, and looked like he belonged. You know, he was scoring for us. He was rebounding. And the one area that was probably the biggest concern with Michael Porter from the Utah series all the way through the Lakers series was the defense. And what I loved was early on in the playoffs, Jim, Utah went at Michael Porter almost every possession. And I challenged Michael. I said, you got to take that personally. You have to make a stand or every other team's going to do the same thing. And I felt that went on. So I'm going to be a third member of our big three, if you want to call it that. He's got size. He's got shooting ability. He rebounds the heck out of the ball. And he's still so young. And that's what I love about our team. We're doing all of this with a really young group. And, you know, often that's not the case. So Michael, Jamal, Nikola, as well as all the other guys on our roster, you know, we're excited for this upcoming season.
We are talking to Michael Malone for another moment or so. And, Michael, you did all of that in the bubble, and you did so without Will Barton. How much does he bring to the team, and what are you able to do when he's healthy?
Well, I tell you what, I think Will, you know, unfortunately was not able to really participate in the bubble. And last season was like, felt like two years. But people probably forget Will was having a great year for us before the season was shut down early in March. He was phenomenal November, December, January. So getting Will Barton back healthy provides us with a versatile player. He can play the one, the two, the three. He's one of the few guys on that team that can get anywhere he wants to on the court. He can play make for his teammates. He rebounds the ball. And I think you raise a good point. We go all the way to the Western Conference Finals without one of our starters in Will Barton, and Gary Harris missed the first five games of the Utah series. So getting Gary back healthy, acclimated, as well as Will Barton, we feel we're an even more dangerous team than we were last season.
So, you know, Michael, finally, I know you're looking forward and not back, but knowing you the way I do, and I value your opinion, I'm curious about this because you were really outspoken about the toll that life in the bubble was taking on, I mean, pretty much everybody, players, coaches, staffers, in terms of the sacrifices that everybody had to make to be away from their families and their normal life. I'm curious, when you look back on the entire bubble experience off the court, what were you able to take away from it?
Yeah, and interesting question, obviously. And, you know, I kept a journal while I was down there. You know, every day I put down my thoughts on paper, and we'll look forward to going back and reflecting upon all those daily thoughts. Because over 83 days, Jim, there is going to be lots of different emotions, a wide range of emotions. Excitement when you first get there. You know, obviously, then you start missing your family. Then the playoffs come around, and you kind of get reengaged. Those competitive juices get going. But I made it a point, you know, while we were down there, and the NBA did a hell of a job of creating a very, you know, safe environment for the players, coaches, staffs, everybody. And that's the biggest challenge this season is that we're not in a bubble. You know, that's what everybody worries about. Are we going to be able to pull this off with COVID obviously still rearing its ugly head? But for me, you know, personally, I just made sure every day I was finding some time for myself. And whether that was going on my daily bike ride, which was kind of stir crazy because you just went around and around a 2-mile loop over and over and over. But for me, I needed that. You know, that was getting out of my room, getting on a bike, going for a walk, getting alone with my thoughts. That brings me balance, and that allows me to be a better coach. And we made such a point of emphasis down the gym of making sure every day we all brought positive energy to the gym. Because if you let the negative side effects of being isolated and away from your family, you could get to a pretty dark place. And the last thing I'll say with that, that was the most impressive thing, of the fact we came back from 2-3-1 deficits. A lot of teams, a lot of players, when you're in a bubble situation and you are isolated from friends and family and you have a ticket to go home right outside your reach, a lot of people would let go of the rope and say, man, I want to get the hell out of here. Our players never let go. We kept on fighting and believing in our goal, and that was probably the most exciting part of that experience, is that we never gave in to adversity, and we never just said, you know what, I'm tired, I want to go home. We fought, we fought, we fought, and that is a great skill to have.
That is so eerie to me, Michael. I mean, you literally said the exact phrase that I was going to use. I was going to follow that and say, in that situation, people will let go of the rope because they have a way out. So as a really quick follow, I would ask you this. Were you journaling as part of the bubble experience, or do you typically journal? Why do you do that?
Oh, interesting question. So I knew full well when the NBA announced plans, okay, you know what, we are going to do this. We are going to finish this season, and we're going to bring, never done before, right? This is history in the making. We're going down to a bubble. I'm not a person who keeps a daily journal. I barely have time to read the paper and kiss my wife goodnight. But I felt while I was down there, this was history in the making, and I knew one day I was going to look back on the different thoughts I had every day. There's going to be things that I read when I look at this journal and say, I forgot about that. And I didn't want that to be the case. I want to be able to have a really detailed recording of each day, the events that happened, the emotions that I had, something that was, you know, maybe a moment with another player on a different team or a coach from a different team that I may have forgotten, and I can reflect upon and revisit. So it's just something where I felt it was important while I'm alone in my room, you know, to be able to do this as part of my daily routine. And that gave me structure and something that I look forward to doing every day.
Daniel, always have it. That's a great move. Michael Malone is the head coach of the Denver Nuggets, led them to the conference finals for the first time in more than a decade. And the season opener is Wednesday night, Sacramento at Denver. Michael, I appreciate you very, very much. And great to have you back on the show. Thanks so much for doing that. And I know we'll talk again soon.
Always a pleasure, Jim. Happy holidays to you and yours, and be safe out there, okay? Thanks a lot.
Like, so what he did last night would be amazing in any situation whatsoever. Like, what Lamar did, he did what superstars do. He elevated his game when the moment demanded it. And he did it again and again and again. And he absolutely rammed a dagger, not just through the heart of that Cleveland defense, but through the heart of an entire city. You do that in any NFL game, and you're a stud. You do that on a Monday night with the entire nation watching. When you're coming back from the locker room on fourth down late in the fourth quarter, and you are an absolute legend. Because whatever he was still recovering from in that situation, whatever it was, when Trace McSorley's leg buckled, and it was fourth down, and it looked like they had no other real option, or a good option, Lamar knew exactly what he had to do.
I got to get back. I'm catching the attitude because I'm like, man, it ain't going the way we want to. And then I see him go down, and I'm like, we got to start. Nah, like, we just got to go out there. Nah, and I start running out there.
That's it. He was catching an attitude. He knew. He knew he had to go out there. So he comes back into the game on fourth down with the season and the playoffs. On the line, he hits Hollywood Brown for a 44-yard TD on the first play. I mean, that really is a Hollywood story. Thing about Lamar, though. Lamar did not run for 5 or 6 yards to get a new set of downs. Lamar went legend with a 44-yard TD pass on the first play out of the locker room on fourth down, fourth and five. And then after Cleveland scores to tie that game, Jackson does it again, leading his team down the field to set it up for a game-winning field goal. I mean, it was amazing. Amazing to everybody outside that locker room, but not the guys inside of it. Mark Andrews, who came up huge last night time and time again, said, we expect this from our guy.
He's resilient. He's resilient in everything he does. He works hard. I think the proof's in the pudding. You know, I think you see everything he's done and how he plays and the way the team fought. And, you know, we're not a team that gets down and can't come back. You know, I think we've shown that this year. We've shown time and time again that we can come back from being down in deficits. And obviously this was a great game and we showed it again.
They did. So when you see greatness like that, it is pretty hard to comprehend. And then there is that mystery surrounding why he left the field in the first place. The initial report was cramps and that he needed an IV. But that did not stop the internet from going wild with its own diagnosis. The internet's got jokes now. Lots of jokes. And the internet was convinced that Lamar Jackson was not dealing with leg cramps or anything like that. The net was convinced that he was dealing with Thuria, a mobile quarterback with the runs. And that combination of those two things is as explosive gets. Explosive as hell. Am I right? The Ravens Twitter feed, Alvin, posted, quote, QB Lamar Jackson, cramps, is questionable to return. And the replies were exactly what you might expect. Quote, let the man bleep in peace, end quote. Or, quote, Ravens doing him dirty. Man's had to bleep, and now it's all over Twitter, end quote. And simply, quote, heard he had to pinch a loaf, end of quote. Within seconds, Lamar Jackson was being photoshopped onto Paul Pierce's body in the wheelchair and referenced with Harry Dunn on the throne. Now, normally I would say the internet is written in ink. Last night, it was written in brown. And it was brutal. And not anonymous. I'm not talking about Twitter eggs. I'm talking about legitimate, credible people in the industry were jumping in. Lana Berry tweeted, quote, a big explosive play indeed. Kimberly A. Martin tweeted, Lamar feeling hella light and spry now. Like, I'm talking really well-respected reporters and thinkers, even executives, and they were going with diarrhea smack. Lamar comes back, he sees McSorley get injured, and he comes back out on the field. And the moment he did, people started comparing it to, well, Willis Reed. I'm here to say, let's go ahead and pump the brakes on that one. Willis Reed hobbling out onto the court in Game 7 of the NBA Finals is one of the most iconic moments in sports history. Him showing up in that game was so inspirational, so motivational, so famous, it transcended sports altogether. It's a moment that people still talk about a half a century later. And you're going to compare what happened last night to Willis Reed. The hell you are. Willis Reed was dealing with like a thigh injury. Lamar Jackson was dealing with something so much worse, allegedly. I mean, you can go ahead and hit that thigh with some ice.
Ice.
You can tape it up. You can't ice or tape up what Lamar was dealing with. You can muscle through a thigh injury. You can't muscle through the great equalizer. Willis Reed did not have to deal with the fear of going Pete McMeat at the worst possible moment.
You have a big dump in your pants.
I mean, you be honest with yourself. You look in the mirror. How many of us are returning to our office jobs, after a bout with the great equalizer? Zero. Absolutely zero. Man, you want to deal with that?
Zero.
Yeah, you'll cancel your plans for a week. Man, you'll bring a pillow and a gallon of Gatorade into the stall with you. Hope for the best. Brace for the worst. Come on, man. Get real with that. Don't bring Willis Reed into this. We'll get into all that. We are joined right now by John Smoltz. John, it's been a minute or two since you and I have spoken. How are you doing, John? How is life for you right now?
You know what? All things considered, it's great. I'm down here in Orlando just making the rounds before in a month. I get an opportunity to defend something again, which is really, really the coolest thing in the world. It's like a major for me. I'm not going to lie. This is what I got now. I'm out of competition. This is my last form of competition.
You know, John, I love that topic. I've talked to so many athletes about that. And when you're wired a certain way and you're wired to compete and that's your identity and that's what you've always done, and then all of a sudden when the games stop, you don't have that same exact outlet. So what is the outlet and how important is it for you to get to, quote, defend something?
Yeah, first and foremost, you know, competing, if I'm in a golf group, I want to win the golf group. If there's a scoreboard, I want to see how far off the scoreboard I can go. So if they're going to keep score and there's a competition, I want to be as good as I can be. So these kind of tournaments, when you're rubbing elbows with some of the greatest players in the world, in this case the LPGA, you just can't help but learn about your golf game. It's 4 days, and I don't play in many four-day events. And at 53 years old, I don't know how many more years I'll have to really excel. So I'm trying to make the most of it. And I just get flat out geeked up when it comes to a tournament. I think every day is my day. Like when I play golf, I think every day is the moment I could shoot my best score. I hope that fire never goes out, because when I get in my 60s, I want to start shooting my age from 66 to 95. After that, well, it doesn't matter as much. But that's my simplest goals in life when it comes around golf, and that's the way I've lived.
We're talking to John Smoltz. The thing is, John, it's not just golf, though. It was not just baseball. It's not just golf. And I say this because over the summer, Tim Kirchen wrote this great piece with your teammates and your coaches talking about how competitive you are. As an example, they talk about this legendary game of horse that you played at Chipper's house back in the day when Ned Yost hit a couple of lucky shots from the deck and one from the street. He said, quote, it would have been the greatest feat of my career. end of quote. But then you came back and you beat him. What do you remember about that day in that game?
I just remember having, my moment of being a teammate or competing against people is always trying to bring out the best in whoever it is, and I want to beat them, and I don't sugarcoat that. And so I always believe until it doesn't happen that I can make the shot, make the pitch, or, you know, get the winning basket. And I love competing, and I guess just the way that my sports career took me, I did it longer than I thought I could, and then golf came around. I played competitive basketball the day I retired till I was 50, and then I realized this is getting a little out of hand. My hips, my body just can't keep this up. So golf has taken all my energy, and I pour whatever I can. If I do something that inhibits golf, I don't do it. So if something's going to hurt me from, you know, being too sore, even though it's fun, I won't do it because I want to play golf.
We're talking to John Smoltz. You know, it's interesting, John, because years ago you told me that what you did on the golf course helped you become a better pitcher, maybe even elongated your career. It's something that I've referenced in numerous other conversations with other athletes over the years. For those who don't know, how did golf impact you as a pitcher?
So for me, I kept my priorities in order when it came to my profession. Obviously, the baseball was going to be the number one priority, and then Bobby knew that. That's why he allowed us to do what we needed to do to make away from the game a little more enjoyable. You pitch once every 5 days, but people don't realize how the game can consume you, right? Whether you had a good game or bad game, the workouts in between, the time in between can either cause you to get stale, get burned out. So we play golf. I play golf every day on the road except for the days that I pitch. I didn't play as much at home with the kids, but I would go home after a game, probably one of the few people that could go to bed right after the game, get up at 7, tee off at 7:30, 8 o'clock, play a round of golf, come back to either the hotel or the park, have lunch, play cards, and then hit reset. You know, do that every day. It just energized me. I never had to take any supplements. I never had to take anything that would give me an energy boost. That was my energy boost. And people used to look at me and go, how can you do this? Why are you so ready to go? And I said, well, simple. My life is revolved around the activities of my sport. And then I don't do anything else. Like, I'm not going to museums. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I'm not staying up till 2-3 in the morning. I'm basically ready to go the next morning, and I'm exercising. It's not a strenuous sport. I'm in a cart 90% of the time, and I probably only hit, you know, when you think about it, you're putting 30 to 34 times. You're hitting maybe 10 to 14 drivers. The rest of your majority of your shots are from 100 yards in. So that simple approach extended my career, Glavin's career, and Maddox's career. We all talked about it after we were done. Don't know if we'd have played as long if it weren't for those times we had away from the game that didn't just swallow us up because of the, you know, the intensity of which our sport created for us all.
You know, it makes so much sense when you lay it out like that, John. But, of course, you hit it straight and you don't three-putt. I could see where it adds years to your life. But you can imagine where it takes years off the rest of our lives, right?
I understand that if, you know, and I get it from an organizational standpoint, if you're a traditional hack or you have a chance to hurt yourself, then that wouldn't be a byproduct of extending your career. I agree. But everybody we played with during our rotation, we either taught how to play golf or mandated they needed to play golf a little bit. Just to get out, and it created, think about the time in the taxi cabs or rental cars, the golf carts on the golf course. We talked about not every hitter, but we talked about baseball. We talked about the subtleties. Our personalities worked to where we wouldn't let each outing or match affect us. And we just had, we got a separator. You know, we did what we had to do on the field. We got a first rate seat to see greatness. And then we enjoyed each other off the field. And what really became the most valuable time of our careers.
Yeah, I feel like I'm kind of a hypocrite, John, because I've joined a number of clubs, and I'm really embarrassed to say this, that I no longer belong to, because I thought that I would get to it, and then I never did actually get to it. But my thinking was that it was almost as much about the quality of the time and the quality of the experience. Like, golf is something that, it's not just in and of itself. Like, in and of itself, it's an amazing thing. But above and beyond that, it could be so good for business. It could be so good socially.
Yep.
Like, where else can you get 3 or 4 hours with a decision maker or somebody who's important to you? How much of it is about that for you?
No doubt. Look, if we could sit at a restaurant, three of us, and we would talk and somebody would inevitably interrupt us, right? There's always a quantity of time that people wanted from us generally good because they're excited to meet or get an autograph. On the golf course, nobody runs up to you. Nobody is interrupting your time. You basically have that time to discuss whatever topic, business, you know, is going on. And it's a place of kind of like serenity where you just at your place of relaxation. We all kind of made it an opportunity to not get mechanical, not consume ourselves with the mechanics of a swing, because mechanics of baseball were too important. You didn't want to get critical of those things. You just kind of took it what it was, and we all progressed in our game eventually. And again, we could talk about the ultimate days off. We can talk about some of the trips we took. That all adds energy that when you go to the ballpark the next day, you're not run down, you're not tired. You kind of like, when's the next one going to be? Or what are we going to do tomorrow? And I told our guys, I said, listen, I'm the golf concierge. I get the rental cars, the tee times. I set everything up. You have one job. Decide before you go to bed if you're going to make it or not. And if not, you're paying a fine, because you can't go to bed deciding you're going to make it and then not show up. And guys got really good at determining what they wanted to do or what activity was most important to them. And, you know, they knew we were playing a top 100 course. We played about 73 of the top 100 courses in the U.S. just in the baseball cities over a course of 10 to 12 years. That's pretty cool.
It's amazing. I'm trying so hard to talk baseball, but this is so good. You know, John, that point that you are the concierge, every group needs one. Every group has to have that guy, and not everybody wants to get on the phone and make that call. Not everybody wants to set that thing up. Is that something you enjoy doing, or did you understand that if we're going to play, somebody's got to do it, so it may as well be me?
Exactly. And I had more of the personality to kind of talk to the pros and members. You meet that one member that knows 14 members. Like, you meet the one guy, which I did, and they've been friends I've been friends with people now through golf forever. And there's not a lot of bad people you meet in fishing or golf. Those are the two kind of rules that I learned by. And I think to make things happen, you know, I took control over it and I made it happen. I took back before we had computers, I had this notebook, and it was, you know, had all the information in there from every city to every golf course member, pro. You call up, you do the thing, you ask the rules, you set it up. And I don't think until after certain guys left, guys really appreciated what I was able to do. And Maddox to this day, you know, talks about all the fun he had and the opportunity. I still get calls from current players. Hey, you got anything in, you know, Pittsburgh? You got anything in me? I still have my list, and now it's all on the digital. And, you know, it was interesting. I carried a briefcase for one sole purpose my whole career, was to carry that notebook. And if I ever lost that notebook or that briefcase, you would have sworn I lost my fastball, slider, and split. I was devastated, so I always had it by me.
Dude, back it up. You got to pack that stuff up. All right, John, so when you talk about the importance of you get to defend something, I'm curious, who are the celebs in the field who concern you the most? Or do you have the approach that they got to deal with you, you're not dealing with them? How are you approaching that defense?
No, you know, it's interesting. I know who's better than me, and that's what drives me. I mean, Mark Mulder and Marty Fish, they're better than me. I mean, guys like Marcus Allen and Ray Allen has come on so fast. He hits the ball so far. Guys like there are probably 7 to 10 people who hit it 30 or 40 by me off the tee. And what I've learned to do is that in a 4-day tournament, that equals out, right? I mean, in a 2-day tournament, I probably wouldn't have as much of a chance. But then they threw in Annika Sorenstam, who's playing this year, who I love playing with, who's going to make it even more special on the celebrity side. Each year, the list grows of players who have a chance to win. 5, 6, 7 years ago, might have been a handful of people. And the same two people were winning all the tournaments, like Marty and Mulder were winning either Diamond prior to the LPGA joining and Tahoe. And Marty, of course, is coming off a course record last year at Tahoe, a 10 under. So it just shows you how much power and, you know, game he has. But I kind of told my daughter this tongue in cheek, but my grandson's 2.5 years old. And I said to my daughter, Rachel, I said, he only knows me as champ. So I got to continue to, you know, I got to defend. He didn't even know I played baseball. So
that's great.
Golf has become my new passion, to where three-peat sounds really good. And, you know, walking into a 4-day tournament, which is no joke, by the way, 3 days is most of the tournaments we play. But this 4-day tournament is a grind, and it's the tortoise and the hare. I really believe that has been my mindset when I teed up the first round, is to just know that there's plenty of time, do your thing, and see what happens on the fourth round.
He is the two-time defending champ in the celebrity division of the Diamond Resorts Tournament of Champions. He is John Smoltz. John, how about one baseball question on the way out the door? You know what it's like to be a team that came so close to winning and then to finally break through. How significant was it for the Dodgers to finally win a World Series after years of coming so close, and what do you expect from them in 2021?
Yeah, last year was the incredibly most difficult, added on top of already, you know, the pressure they had. I said last year would be the hardest, no matter who won, would be the hardest championship to win. And the reason that would be the hardest championship to win, I know people are going to say it was only 60 games. There were more hoops, more things to go through. Personalities didn't work well with the COVID rules and all the pandemic. You know, I'm only talking about sports. I'm not talking about life. Life was way harder for people. I'm talking about the sport of baseball and what they had to do differently than what you were. Creatures of habit. And I can just safely say that if I was playing today, my ability to be successful would have been hampered because it's not in my DNA. I like being around people. I like, you know, being close to guys and doing the things in the clubhouse that you couldn't do this year. To have all the restrictions that these players had to adhere to and to come out on top like the Dodgers did is incredible. Not to mention, that's not even talking about the stress they had before this year started with the pressure of what they hadn't done in the last 30 years. So, look, I tip my hat to them because of these kind of rule changes and really all the things they had to do. They checked the box. They should have lost to the Los Angeles Dodgers, but the year we won, we probably should have lost to the Colorado Rockies. There's always that moment. You know, the Dodgers should have lost to the Braves, but there's always that moment where the teams kind of, when they come back, they check that, like, okay, now we got it, because they did not play their best in that series. And they were a moment away from, you know, having the same narrative continue. So this year, this past year, when I watched what teams had to do, it's a credit to all individual players who were able to get through the season, because it was not easy.
Agreed. John Smoltz joining us, World Series champion, member of the Baseball Hall of Fame, and he's got a big event on January 21st through the 24th, a four-day event that he's got to defend. John, that's a great conversation. I appreciate you. I appreciate getting caught up. Take care of yourself. Stay safe. I know you got a big one coming up, and it's always good to run you down, John.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hassan Reddick is my guest. Hassan, it's great to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Good, good. It's good to visit with you. I've got to ask, when you're coming off a game like that on Sunday, can you take me back to before the game? What were you thinking and feeling going into that game? Did you have any idea that you had something like that or something special in you going into the game?
Man, going into the game, you know, I had set a goal, you know, and that was just to get one. I went a couple weeks without a sack, and I definitely knew I needed one this week, but I did not know that was going to happen. It was crazy, man, crazy.
I mean, crazy. Five sacks, three forced fumbles. There was a stretch in the second half where it seemed like you were completely unblockable and you were getting to the quarterback nearly every single play. Like, what's it like when you're in the middle of a zone like that?
It's crazy, because just like you said, I felt unblockable. It felt like they just couldn't stop me, and I just wanted to keep going. Like, how many more can I get? Can I get more? You know, and they just kept racking up, piling up one after another.
I mean, when you're in a zone like that and you're getting that many that quickly, at some point, did you even know how many you had? I mean, were you clearly aware, like, all right, I got two, I got three, I got four, or do you lose track?
No, I wasn't even keeping count. I didn't know that I had five until after the game was over. One of our PR guys came over, talked to me. You know, I didn't even know I had broke the franchise record until he had told me. So once he told me that, I was filled with all kind of joy.
Right.
Kind of joy, man.
Or done something that had not been done since 2002. Hassan Reddick is my guest. You know, when you talk about doing something like that, and there's a number of reasons why you'd be filled with joy, but when you have five sacks and three forced fumbles in a game, it's special no matter where you do it, but you're from New Jersey. Was it a little more significant or special to do it closer to home?
Yeah, it definitely was. You know, because playing for the Cardinals, when we play home in the desert, more times than not, the game doesn't come on TV back home, you know. So being so close to home, the game was on TV, and all my family got to watch, friends from back home got to watch, you know. And I just seen them sending me highlight after highlight after highlight through text message or through social media. All my family and friends cheering me on. So to do it at home was amazing.
Hassan Reddick is joining us. At the end of that game, you were pretty emotional. Can you give me a sense, like, what kind of thoughts and feelings were running through you in that moment?
Like I said, I was filled with joy. I was blessed, you know. I felt blessed because it's not – the next time we may see somebody have this performance, it could be a long time, you know, and the fact that it was me, myself, you know, it just seemed crazy to me, and to think about my journey and everything that I've been through, and, you know, to hit the goal that I had set for this year with, you know, being a full-time outside linebacker this year, to hit that goal, especially in one day, for the most part, it was crazy.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. It's about the journey. It really is about the journey, which I'll get to in a minute, but I want to ask you this. Now you're sixth in the league in sacks. You're getting a lot of run as a Pro Bowl candidate. What would it mean to you to get voted into the Pro Bowl?
It would mean a lot. You know, that's something that, you know, the fans – and people, you know, around the country and world get to vote for. So, you know, to get that type of recognition, it'd be crazy. Another great accolade to put on my resume, and something that I'm hoping to get.
Hassan Reddick is joining us. You know, when we talk about your journey, so people understand the journey and they're aware of it. You were a defensive back in high school, and then you walked on in college after dealing with injuries in high school. So what were the early days in college like for you?
My early days, started off playing DB, you know, cornerback and safety, you know, but wasn't getting much play time. Ended up changing my position to linebacker, inside linebacker for like one game. And then after that game, ended up going to defensive end, you know, being a 215, 220-pound defensive end in college, where I played the rest of my career at in college. You know, just each year I got better at it, learning how to rush the passer on a college level. Each year I got better at it, and you know, that helped boost me, boost my grade to a first round grade for the NFL draft.
See, I think it's one thing to have those kind of challenges on the field, but the fact of the matter is, I mean, at one point you actually walked on at Temple, and the story goes your family had to take out an additional loan just so you could be on the meal plan so you would not feel left out when the other players were eating. So when you look back on those days and when you see where you are right now and then you see the sacrifices you made, the sacrifices your family made, how much pride is there in the way that you, in fact, everyone battled for you to get to this spot?
Oh, man, it's crazy to look back on it, you know, because it just seemed like it was so many obstacles in my way that was just going to stop me, you know. It was almost like I wasn't supposed to be here. But, you know, it's crazy to be the, like, Snickers Hungriest Player of the Week, because during my whole career, I've just been hungry, you know. I just kept working, kept going, never letting anything stop me, not any coaches, players, nobody, never letting anybody get in my way, and always overcoming the obstacles or whatever was thrown at me to get where I wanted to be.
So what about that Snickers chain? What about that? You get that for that performance. For those who do not know, exactly what is the chain and how good does it feel to have that chain?
Nah, it feels good. So, you know, Ben Baller, he made the chain, and it goes to a different player each week who had a crazy performance. I got it this week, and it's a good thing to have it, you know, because it lets me know that my hard work is paying off and that I'm being recognized. And that's all I really wanted was, you know, to show that I belong, to show that I could play outside linebacker on an NFL level. And with recognition like this, man, it lets me know that I'm on the right path and that I got to continue to work, continue to stay hungry, and continue to progress.
Hassan Reddick, my guest, before I let you go, there's two really important things. One point that you just made and something else I want to ask you. Like, it's one thing to have, quote, a crazy performance and get that recognition. It's one thing to have a huge game, but the fact is you had a huge game in a critical game for your team. The team had lost three straight going into that Giants game. So what's it mean to step up and have that kind of game when your team needed it most?
It means a lot. I always want to be a player that the team can lean on, you know. I always want to be a player that, you know, coaches feel comfortable calling my number, knowing that I could get the job done or that I'm going to be able to make the play. And to be able to spark my team and build momentum the way I did, you know, the energy on the sidelines was crazy, you know, from the players and the coaches. And to step up in a game that means so much, I just hope that we take this spark and we continue to, you know, stay on a roll, keep this momentum going so that we could continue to push and try to achieve our goal.
You know, and then in terms of being on the outside, you mentioned that a couple of times, and the journey that you and I are talking about, there were not just tough and challenging moments in college. There was certainly that, but there were tough and challenging moments also once you got to the NFL. Last season, D coordinator Vance Joseph moved you from the inside out to the edge. So then what has that transition been like for you, and what does that coach mean to you?
The transition has been wonderful, you know, because now I'm back to playing football the way that I know how, which is going around and, you know, letting my talent take over instead of thinking so much, you know. So the fact that, you know, Vance understands that and put me in a position where I can be effective, you know, it just means so much to me. And it's something that's worked out, you know. It's worked out for me, it's worked out for him, it's worked out for the defense and the team as a whole. So, you know, for us to come together and, you know, make that decision to move back and for it to work out the way that it has been is just phenomenal.
Yeah, listen, I appreciate the time so much. One last thought. You mentioned building on this. Hopefully you build on this and use this as momentum. You're fighting for a playoff spot. You've got three games to go. So how are you approaching the rest of the schedule?
The same way I approach it every week, you know. That's how can I be better than the last week, you know. Might be tough to top stat-wise, but just going out there, giving my all, and, you know, looking forward to helping the team and trying to make this push.
Dude, if you're better this week than you were last week and you had five sacks and three forced fumbles last week, I guarantee you will be on next week on this show once again. He is Hassan Reddick. He's an outside linebacker for the Cardinals. The recipient of the Snickers chain is the Hungriest Player of the Week. Hassan, great to have you on. Congrats on that performance and nice to talk to you, man. Appreciate it.
Right. Thank you, Jim. Appreciate you as well.
Good night now.